All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from New York City on this the 22nd day of September 2020. Before I talk more about today's show, let me remind you, I do write a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks that focuses primarily on junior exploration companies. We're having a little bit of a hiatus here, a little bit of a downturn in the mining sector in the last few days, but I think that is really very healthy development in terms of the gold sector, and certainly gives people another chance to get into some of these situations. They're kind of difficult to buy into a stock that's going straight up and not taking a little time to base and provide some value for investors. So I take this as a good time for people to start looking and doing their homework and understanding the stories that I cover in my newsletter. You can go to miningstocks.com to sign up for my letter, Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. And if you'd like to plug Chen Lin's letter as well, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling, go to chenpicks.com for that. Excellent coverage on the biotechs as well as the mining and energy sector. And I do want to thank all of you for listening to this show and making one of the more popular shows, the Voice America Business Channel. And also want to encourage you to continue sending along any comments you have about this show. Good, bad, or indifferent, we'd like to hear from you. I also want to thank our sponsors, as I always do, for making this show economically viable. NV Gold, Hannon Metals, Irving Resources, Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, Lion One Metals, SK Mining, Grand Portage, and GMV Minerals are the sponsors for this week's show. Before I get started on today's show, let me remind you that I will be launching my Investing 101 Gold and Silver in the Mining Shares on October 1st. And to learn more about my course, you can go to my YouTube page. It's the J. Taylor Media YouTube page. You can learn more about what's going on in the next few days as we get ready to launch on October 1st. And to learn more about the course content, you can go to course.miningstocks.com, course.miningstocks.com. And you can also, I believe, provide an email there so we can keep you up to date as the time approaches October 1st for the launch. All right, I've titled today's show, Inflation and Other Revolutionary Forces at Work in America. Alistair MacLeod and Daniel McAdams return. Daniel hasn't been with me for a number of years, but Alistair, as a regular guest, will join me in the second half of today's show. The fallacies of John Maynard Keynes are obvious for anyone with the willingness to use their eyes to see. But as Alistair will point out, cognitive dissonance causes most economists to explain away the obvious truth that lower interest rates do not stimulate economic growth and higher prices. Instead, lower rates only serve to redistribute wealth to the very top 0.1%, for example. That's where most of the new wealth is going. The massive redistribution of income is no doubt a part of the violent uprisings in major U.S. cities and now appears to be a color revolution sponsored by elements within the CIA to remove Trump from office if he isn't defeated in November. In other words, we have enemies from within that seek to destroy our Republican form of government set up by our founding fathers that was intended to protect the minority while giving power to the people and not to the government, with limited government power. That was their goal. It's clear that the far left that now controls, seems to at least control the Democrat Party, wants to get rid of all of those institutions that get in the way of power of for government, for a more powerful government. Now, all those institutions that our founding fathers put in place, our founding fathers believed that the best government was the least government, and because you, unless you have a government that is balanced and held in check, it can very quickly enslave its citizens. That has been the norm more often than not throughout history. But alas, it seems that these basic civics lessons that have been taught in the ages past anyway, that I learned when I was in grade school, are no longer taught in our educational system. And so now we have a growing angry mob of people who think the only way to get what they want is through violence. Whereas all citizens are guaranteed by the Constitution equal protection under the law, equal rights in other words, they are not written into the Constitution is the right to equal outcome, because each of us, as the Constitution understood, are given different gifts, different abilities. Everyone is not the same. Each person, our Constitution, and at least our Declaration of Independence said we are each created by God with inalienable rights that He has given us. So we have the right to be what God made us to be. So a free market economic system rewarded has in the past rewarded excellence. Yes, it punishes failure. That causes people to be sharper and to work harder the next time. But there has always been, in the past at least, the sense in America that if you failed, you get up and you can try again and again and again, and just maybe one day you'll be successful. Lots of stories through history of people who fell on hard times and really worked extremely hard and did well when they were given the freedom to do so. But now, out of ignorance, we are heading in a very precarious direction. One of our main political parties has said that if they win the Senate, they will do away with the filibuster in the Senate. They will further eliminate the First Amendment with more hate speech legislation, increase the number of members in the Supreme Court so that they can control the majority there and define the laws as they desire, add to Washington, D.C., add two states, that being Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, as a way to ensure that the Democrats gain more members in the Senate and have control of that legislative body, and eliminate the Electoral College so that the president is elected by a simple majority. Our founding fathers put all of these things in place to protect the minority. They feared that we would have mob rule, and it seems as though that is sort of what's heading our way in many ways as we look at Portland and Seattle and New York and elsewhere. In effect, a pure democracy, which wasn't written into the Constitution, in fact, it wasn't, the word democracy doesn't appear in the Constitution. It wasn't until the progressives of President Wilson and others started to proclaim democracy as their religion, it wasn't until then that we started to think that democracy was the only viable and good way of governing. But certainly, with that has come the notion of the mobocracy. So get rid of the Electoral College, get rid of all the other safeguards that I just named that the founders put in place so that the party in control can have complete control and there will be no debate over issues that affect the American people. Well, I do not believe for a minute that most Democrats really understand what they will be voting for, because they don't understand the wisdom of our founding fathers. Again, I don't believe it's being taught in the schools. They simply think that they can have their cake and eat it too. Various factions, if you go to the Russian Revolution, various factions that thought that they were very much a part of the movement found out that their heads were on the chopping block shortly thereafter, because in a tyranny, there cannot be that many people voicing their views on things. Unfortunately, Americans have become used to having that kind of freedom, and I think there is an assumption that it will always be there, no matter if we get rid of these safeguards to protect the minorities. So I think you could make the case that what's been going on, the bloody revolution has already started possibly in the U.S., but there's a special kind of revolution I'm talking about, also going on, and that is a color revolution, which the CIA instituted in overthrowing the elected governments in the Ukraine and governments in North Africa during the Obama years. There is reason to believe some of the same operatives are engaging in that kind of activity here. Daniel McAdams, who will join me right after the first commercial break, and who every day with former presidential candidate Ron Paul speaks and provides a television show and every day at the Ron Paul Institute. He will be with me after the first commercial break to talk more about the color revolutions that he's familiar with, and we'll ask him if he thinks they may actually be taking place here now. When you can't get what you want through the voting box or whatever, well, then maybe there's another way. But certainly what I think both parties have really not paid attention to, both Republicans and Democrats, and that is inflation. Vladimir Lenin has reportedly said, quote, "The best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By any continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens," end of quote. We most certainly right now have a debasement of our currency underway like never before. Well, maybe it could be compared to the Civil War, I'm not sure, but there was an enormous amount of inflation at that time. And we are seeing massive amounts of money creation, and you could argue that it isn't showing up yet in the inflation numbers that the government provides, but Alistair McLeod will certainly have something to say about that in the second half of today's show. I do firmly believe that this redistribution of wealth to an elite few is a big, big problem in our country. And there's no way that it can be fixed other than going back to there's no way it can be fixed, at least in a good way, unless we go back to some sort of an honest monetary system. So we'll be speaking to Alistair in the second half of today's show. He'll be talking about this inflation issue, why it is a huge problem, and also talk about how China is sitting back and watching things deteriorating in the United States financially, socially, spiritually, I would suggest, in many ways, and perhaps seeing that its time has come or its time is nearing when it might try to take advantage of a very weakened United States of America. So these are very difficult and troubling times for sure. We really need to hold true to our faith. I think a time for a faith in the Almighty and realizing that life in this world isn't all that we have. There is something beyond that. But in any event, we do need to try to be level-headed and approach things logically and scientifically as we move forward into these most difficult times. And most certainly, of course, getting rid of fiat money, which is very rapidly deteriorating in its purchasing power, and acquiring honest money, gold and silver, which holds its value over long periods of time, is an obvious move that people who are able to should make. We do have to go to break now, but don't go away, because Daniel McAdams will be with me right after the break, and we'll hear what he has to say. It's been a long time since I've talked to Daniel on this show, so I'm really looking forward to it. I'll be right back with Daniel McAdams.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Novo Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me Daniel McAdams. It's been a long time, a number of years, I think, since Daniel was last with me. He teams up with Ron Paul at the Institute of Peace and Prosperity. He usually provides a little video discussion of some of the major issues in play every day at ronpaulinstitute.org. So I'd really suggest you folks might want to visit the ronpaulinstitute.org for some refreshing ideas about what's transpiring these days and why things are happening the way they are. Daniel is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, and he served as foreign affairs advisor to Congressman Paul from 2001 until Dr. Paul's retirement at the end of 2012. In the 1990s, Daniel worked as a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, including an editorial page editor of the Budapest Sun. He also served as special rapporteur for the British Helsinki Human Rights Group while based in Europe, monitoring human rights and elections on the ground in various contentious states, including Albania, during the 1996-1998 civil unrest. So Daniel's had a tremendous background in international geopolitics. He's been involved with a whole lot of different organizations, and now his daily activities at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Thanks for joining me again, Daniel.
It's great to be back with you again, Jay. Thanks for having me.
It's really good, and I'm glad to know that the hurricane didn't wipe you out down there today, Daniel. I know you're down there in South Texas, off of the, and it was a nothing burger for you, you said, so we're really thankful that you're with us. I believe I'd like to get your thoughts about the obvious desire to destroy the U.S. Constitution. I talked about it in my opening monologue about how especially the really aggressive liberal Democrats seem to be interested in tearing everything down, the safeguards that our founding fathers put in place, you know, such as the Electoral College and, you know, every state getting two senators and, you know, and having the right to filibuster in the Senate floor and all those things they seem to want to take away. What do you think is happening to us? Why do you think, do these people not understand the reasons that those institutions were created and why they were for our own good, why they were created? Or is it an ignorance, or what do you make of it?
Well, I don't think it's an ignorance. I think they know exactly what they're doing. And, you know, one of the causations, and you would, I'm sure, agree with this, is that the stakes are too high. Washington has too much power. There's too much to be gained to hold on to the levers of power. And if we had the kind of government that you and I would prefer, the really stakes wouldn't be that high. There wouldn't be that much incentive. You wouldn't be controlling trillions of dollars and controlling people's lives. So the fact that the government is so big is one of the causative factors for this mad dash for power. But no, it's not ignorance on their part. These people are essentially, whether they know it or not, are Maoist in spirit. They want to destroy all the institutions of our society and rebuild them in a new image. And that image has been informed by, among other things, of course, our popular culture, but also particularly by their university professors and their entire educational background, which has taught them that everything that we value as a republic is a tool of oppression that must be overthrown. And so they know exactly what they're doing. Maybe the foot soldiers are not as well versed, but certainly the people that are guiding them know exactly what they're doing, and this year has been a banner year for them.
Well, they may know, but I'm guessing that the vast majority of people who will vote for Joe Biden are not aware of what is at stake here.
Yeah, I think that's true. I certainly don't think the majority of the people that are voting for Biden are down there ripping down statues and burning up police stations. Mm-hmm. You know, however, you do have that element leading and guiding the party and guiding the more radical wing of the party. You know, the irony, Jay, is that as much as this is portrayed as a battle to the death between two radically different competing ideologies, the fact of the matter is there really is very little difference. This fake news of a partisan divide in the U.S. Is something that's very caustic. There really mm-hmm. isn't that much difference between the two parties. Mm-hmm. It's between really tyranny and liberty, and that battle has not even begun.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I mean, there's issues. We see some issues on the Supreme Court, of course, which is a hot one. But when it comes down to the issue of tyranny, freedom, limited government, which Republicans have long ago, I guess maybe Barry Goldwater, Ronald Reagan, to at least gave lip service to it, although he built up spending like mad. So he built up the government very dramatically when he was in power as well. So I think Republicans, and certainly when it comes to monetary policy, as Ron Paul knows as well as you, that Republicans don't seem to be concerned about spending enormous amounts of money any longer, or to printing money to paying for things either. So these are topics that I'll be talking to Alistair McLeod about in the second half of today's show. But so it seems as though that we had a soft coup, an attempted coup d'etat against Trump. First, they with Russia, the trumped up things about Russia, and then you had the Ukraine. Supposedly, Trump was doing stuff in Ukraine that was crooked and everything else. But you know a lot about the Ukraine and about coups and about color revolutions and so forth. What can you tell us about the Ukraine? Because when we had you on more frequently a few years back, you talked a lot about the Ukraine. You talked a lot about what was going on with the color revolution there. How do these color revolutions work, Daniel?
Well, one of the most important things is to cause a disorientation in society. And you find these primarily in societies in transition. And that's why they were pretty common in Central and Eastern Europe, many of the countries of the former Soviet sphere of influence, because they were greatly transitioning societies from a command economy to a slightly more free economy. But when you had the elites controlling that transition and not wanting to let go of the reins of power, you had to prevent against any populism, against anyone who would go against the power that they had. And that's why the color revolutions that I monitored in the 90s included those against people like Vladimir Mečiar in Slovakia, who was a populist, and Sali Berisha in Albania, who was a radical free market populist type. But those people had to be undermined so that the people who represented the former nomenklatura could remain in power, essentially, de facto, if not de jure. And you're seeing a lot of that in the United States. You know, the Trump phenomena surprised everyone. Mm-hmm. He wasn't expected to win. People believed the polls saying that 97% chance of Hillary winning. I think that was the New York Times the day before the election or something like this. So people believed these things. So when Trump actually did win, that, I think, is when the color revolution started in the U.S. We're supposed to be talking about whether there'll be a color revolution after this election. I would put forth that it started the day that President Trump won office. You have to, in the military jargon, you have to have an intelligence preparation of battlefield before you start the battle. And that's what we had in the U.S., an intelligence preparation of battlefield. Established the idea and continue it for 4 years, that President Trump was elected illegitimately. It was Vladimir Putin. It was other things that got him elected. He was not elected by the American people, and that's what his opponents have done over and over from day one. So, yes, the color revolution started November 4 years ago.
Interesting. So that all this attempted impeachment – and of course the Mueller investigation, which came up empty, completely empty, I believe, and then the Ukrainian impeachment is all part of that game, you think?
Absolutely, it's all intended to establish the idea that the Trump is not a legitimate president, And right. I do not say this as a Trump supporter.
I'm no, I know that.
When it comes to voting. So I have no, I have no dog in the race. But yeah. I don't know if you've read about this, if you're familiar with this. I'm sure you are because I heard your monologue earlier and you did reference it. But this Transition Integrity Project and Whitney Webb, who's a great writer, a great investigative reporter, she wrote about it not long ago on her website, which readers can go to. It's the Unlimited Hangout. And she talks about this Transition Integrity Project got together to war game several different scenarios. Ostensibly, if Trump loses and refuses to leave the White House. But In fact, one of the war games was Trump has a clear victory, and then what do you do? And that is a fascinating article. This really did happen. John Podesta played the role of Biden in this war gaming, and you mentioned some of the potential outcomes. This is a pretty big organization. It counts among its members extremely prominent people, including its co-founder, Rosa Brooks, who was a Pentagon and State Department official under Obama. She also worked for a little place called the Open Society Foundation.
George Soros.
Know very well what that is. Yes,
George Soros. Yeah.
He was a general counsel to the president of Soros' foundation. And as you know, Jay, Soros was himself behind most of the color revolutions, including investing very heavily in the Ukraine revolution. Mm-hmm. So you're having a nexus between the actual real color revolutions in Central and Eastern Europe and the very individuals who were involved in attempting to undermine the results of this next election before they even happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have now, it's moving on to a more violent stage now. We've seen in Portland and Seattle and New York and, of course, Minneapolis and various other cities. And then we have COVID. Do you think all these things are just sort of coincidental, they just happened, or do you think there might be some collusion involved with these different events? Because if the aim is to keep people confused, they certainly have done a great job.
Yeah, and confused and disoriented. But yeah. Another important aim is to prepare Americans in America for the idea of martial law. And certainly if you look at the response to the coronavirus, particularly in the blue states, and mm-hmm. if you look at what has happened with violence in particularly the blue states, you're seeing an America that's being prepared for the idea of martial law. How quickly mm-hmm. people have accepted that somehow the government has the authority to force them to stay at home, to not go to their jobs, to not go to their churches, to yeah. not go to their restaurants, to put a filthy rag on their face and walk around with it all day. This yeah. idea that there's an authority among governors and mayors of these states to push mm-hmm. people around like this mm-hmm. is unprecedented. And then when you look yeah. at the unrest in these cities, even people who even, frankly, myself, it's not that I'm wanting martial law, but when I look at these thugs beating up innocent people, I'm thinking, damn, I don't want to defund the police. I want to send them in there to take care of this horrible chaos. These people are absolute thugs. So, yes, I think we're being psychologically prepared to accept the idea of martial law, and that is extremely frightening.
Well, it is frightening to those of us who have lived in this country for so long, and I've talked to many people from Eastern Europe who said that their parents came here just to avoid with this very thing that's going on now. So it is frightening, and I guess we're out of time now, Daniel. I can't believe we're out of time already. Summing up here, though, what you address these issues frequently at the Ron Paul Institute, right? So people should go to hear what you have to say there at ronpaulinstitute.org.
Yeah, and we have our daily show. It's on YouTube. Ron Paul Liberty Report is our mm-hmm. channel there, and we're actually getting close to 250,000 subscribers to our YouTube channel. So we do every day live at noon Eastern time. We do a broadcast Monday through Friday. So we'd love to have your listeners join us as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Daniel. We'll have to have you back when we can have you for more time. Thank you so much for being with us, and
thanks
we'll do
lot.
It again sometime, hopefully very soon. Take care. All right, folks, so we have to go to break. We'll be right back with Alistair MacLeod right after the break. Don't go away. Alistair has some very important things to tell you.
Voice America is available on your Google connected device.
Okay, Google, play Turning Hard Times into Good Times podcast on iHeartRadio.
Try it today.
NV Gold Corp, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTC, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in North America. With an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2020, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors including Eric Sprott, a globally recognized technical team, technical coverage from industry gold experts, and cash in its treasury. Visit nvgoldcorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm Jay Taylor, your host, and I'm really happy to have Alistair McLeod with me once again. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
It's really good to have you, and we need to tell everybody that they should go every Thursday to goldmoney.com to read your latest missives, because they really are full of insights. If people really care to understand why things are happening the way they are and not be satisfied with the superficial explanations you get on CNBC and elsewhere, Then I would suggest you read what Alistair has to say at goldmoney.com. Alistair, I'd like today to talk to you, or have you talk to us, I should say, about inflation, deflation, and other fallacies. You wrote that article on September 10th, and then China is killing the dollar. That was September 17th. Starting with your September 10th article, I'd like to ask you to explain some of the conventional wisdom that we hear every day in the financial medium that are essentially fallacies. You note that the most egregious of these fallacies is that inflation can only occur as the handmaiden of economic growth, while deflation is similarly linked to a recession spinning out of control into the maelstrom of a slump. And end of quote. And I would say this may certainly be the most egregious fallacies, but it is one of the most, I think, one of the most believed doctrines of the Keynesian religion. And so, you know, most people see inflation as a positive thing. They think that's really good because it shows that we're starting to stimulate growth. Money is pumped into the system, so the demand side starts to pick up. And so they're actually looking for inflation as a sign that they're doing good work. But can you explain why this idea, taken as gospel truth, is a falsehood?
Yes, sure. I mean, if it was really true that we want to pay high prices for goods, then we wouldn't go to the supermarket and look at the shelves for the things that are sort of, you know, buy one, get one free, or 20% off, or whatever. I mean, it's complete nonsense. I mean, the idea basically seems to be, at least this is the story, that if, let us say, we think that prices of things are going to be higher tomorrow, then we will hurry up and buy them today, and that way bring demand forward. But I mean, that's a load of rubbish. That only applies in a situation, really, where inflation is actually running at such a rate that is demonstrably true. But for, you know, under normal circumstances, we know that the rate of inflation, price inflation in America is running at about 10%. Forget what the CPI says. We know that's a load of rubbish. Mm-hmm. It's running about 10%. But you know, does that mean we sort of rush out and actually sort of think, oh, I must buy things before it goes up by 0.001% day to day? No, it doesn't. I mean, it's a complete nonsense. The reason that the macroeconomists push the inflation story story is actually quite simple, and that is to allow them to print money as part of government funding. And also, by printing money and lowering interest rates, they lower the cost of government borrowing. So that is your real reason. The sort of economic conditions that really suit ordinary people like you and me are essentially mildly deflationary. Now, what I mean by that is that competition with sound money mm-hmm. drives down prices over time. So I looked at sort of approximate prices between about 1820 and before the First World War, and I would say the general price level fell to roughly 0.4% of what it was before. Now, this is a difficult thing over a long period of time mm-hmm. because you can't really compare one set of goods with another set of goods simply because people are doing different things. At the start of that period, there was a lot of subsistence living. Ordinary people just basically made enough or grew enough in order to survive, and maybe just a tiny bit left over to clothe themselves and heat themselves, not much more than that. But mm-hmm. towards the end of the Industrial Revolution, of course, there was widespread prosperity. We hear all the Dickensian stories about workhouses and all the rest of it, but that was actually just a very small part of the economy. And quite honestly, I think a modern economy has probably got more misfits, unemployed, however you like, sponges, however you like to define it, because the state will provide. But the natural condition is that through competition, prices basically decline over time. And that leads us to another thing, because if you have sound money, in other words, there is no increase in the quantity of money in the economy, then as prices fall, guess what? GDP falls. Now, that's meant to be a very bad thing. You could look at it another way, and that is with inflation. If you just pump the GDP figure full of false money, then your GDP number rises, and that actually is the basis of the fallacy behind it all. This is why nobody questions it.
Yeah. So the incentive of government to borrow and to buy votes or to spend money that they can be involved with somehow enriching themselves. We see the military-industrial complex. Washington in the United States has grown to be such a monstrous. All of these different bureaucracies are just absolutely huge budgets, and there are people living high on the hog around Washington. One of the wealthiest areas in the country is around Washington, D.C., because all of these people that are involved in government and government handouts and so forth. So I guess that's the incentive, though you certainly wouldn't get that if you in your Economics 101 course, your Keynesian course, would you, at the university? They wouldn't tell you that's the reason you do it. So people really do believe these fallacies. There's others that you talk about as well here. You're a little bit hard on supply siders and demand siders. Why are they both wrong-minded? We have the Republicans here that tend to be supply siders, Larry Kudlow, for example, and some of the others. And you have the Democrats, which, of course, are full-fledged Keynesians. They want to spend and print money and so forth to pay for it. They're both wrong. You're saying they're both policies are lead down the wrong path.
Well, yes, because whether a government is trying to drive demand or whether they're trying to drive supply, basically what they're doing is they're interfering in the economy. The supply side, driving the supply side is probably slightly better, if you like, than trying to drive demand, because demand is driven, purely by the inflation story that we've just been mm-hmm. Talking about. And, of course, that actually ends up transferring wealth from people to the state. Supply-siders, the idea behind supply-side is that government subsidizes business, which is, in one sense is is not too much of a sin, but it subsidizes business at the expense of everybody else, because you end up with a larger budget deficit, and unless savings increase to fund that deficit, that deficit is funded through inflation. So and with supply side, if you've got an awful lot of time, you can probably create a case that you start off with a higher budget deficit, but the taxes will roll in later. The point behind it is, it's all about taxes. It's all about getting taxes in. From the government's point of view, they will only go down the supply side route if they believe at the end of the day that they will get more tax as a result. And indeed, they openly recommend it on that basis. So, this is why I don't really hold too much truck for either of those parties.
Yeah, well, it seems that's all they know to do, or all they really want to do, because I guess if you were to roll things back now, this is a problem. If you were to try to go back and reduce government spending, the pain would be very great. And so from getting from where we are now to a more ideal situation, if people would even recognize that as being ideal, the Mises, the free market people understand it, but obviously it's not in the mindset of most university graduates, so... the established order, then, of course, doesn't believe the established order doesn't believe prices can rise in a falling economy, right? So they think that the only way prices can rise is if prices are, if the economy is booming.
Yeah.
But in fact, you just pointed out during the Industrial Revolution, the opposite was true.
Well, the reason that you get the reason you get greater inflation when an economy is contracting is because both production and consumption, we're both producers and consumers, and that happens for every in every state of the economy. So if you have a situation where you've got expanding production and expanding employment and you've got sound money, then you can get falling prices. I think we've gone through that. But the other side, the other aspect of this is that if you get an economy which is in distress, going down, as it were, then it's not just demand that goes down, which if it was just demand, it would lead to lower prices. But also because everybody who demands as a consumer is also a producer, unless he's unemployed, of course. But one way or the other, the two things are just tied together. And, of course, Say's Law tells us that this is the case. And guess what? The first thing that the macroeconomic community did was deny the validity of Say's Law. So they're not going to get the right answer anyway. It's as simple as that.
Well, there seems to be almost no concern now that, it seems to be taken as a given by the establishment, by the mainstream press anyway, that interest rates are going to stay low forever. They can't rise. You have a different view of that, I think. And tell us how Mother Nature might go to work to make that not true. That the powers that be can no longer force rates to some negative level or whatever level they want.
Well, we have a situation at the moment where the government is financing itself through inflation. Forget the idea that the Fed is independent and all the rest of it. I mean, the fact is the government is financing itself through monetary inflation. The effect of that is to drive down the purchasing power of the dollar. Now, it doesn't happen sort of, evenly, but what can happen, and this is something that people don't appreciate, is that a relatively small amount of increase in the quantity of dollars can actually drive the price, the purchasing power of the dollar down quite sharply. And this was certainly, I was looking actually at the situation in Germany for a current article, which I'm working on, in 1923. And there was a period in Germany where amount of paper mark circulation increased by something like 28 times, but the price effect was to increase the quantity of paper dollars paper marks to the dollar by over 300 times. And it claimed at the time that this disproved the quantity theory of money. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually disprove it. All it does is it tells us that there is another factor involved in that, and that is, if you like, human choice, which, of course, is something that the economics of aggregates does not recognize.
Right.
So what we're going to see, I think, specifically, and it always happens this way, the first sellers of a currency which is inflating are the foreigners. And in America's case, because the dollar is the reserve currency, because everything internationally is priced in dollars, there is a very substantial ownership, foreign ownership of dollars, yeah. Considerably greater ownership of dollars than ownership of foreign currencies by American residents. Mm-hmm. The value of all the securities held by foreigners is in the order of $20.5 trillion.
Wow.
That is just slightly more than the current US GDP. On top of that, there's a further $6.3, I think it is, $6 trillion of cash and treasury bills and commercial bills, bills of less than 6 months maturity. In foreign hands. So mm-hmm. Total $27 trillion. Now, that sort of has accumulated really through two factors. Firstly, you have countries and commercial entities exporting to America, doing business with America, seeing their business gradually expand, and so have more dollars, if you like, on a trade-related basis than they would in a more static relationship. So they And that was certainly the case up until 2018, the end of 2018. Mm-hmm. Since then, obviously, international trade has taken a huge, great hit because of the tariff war between America and China.
Right.
So the other aspect is that, of course, portfolio investment has meant that the value of bonds and the value of equities held as financial securities has increased quite significantly. Now, with the foreigners having far too many dollars, they've got the liquidity. I mean, mm-hmm. A lot of people argue that when you get a crisis, everybody's got to have dollars. No, they have to have liquidity. They got over $6 trillion of liquidity. That is not a problem. But if they begin to take the view, and this was the point about the second article you're referring mm-hmm. to about China's on the dollar, if they take the view the dollar is going to go down, then there's only going to be one thing they do. They will sell it, and the dollar mm-hmm. will fall, and the dollar will fall substantially, and it'll get to a point where it starts affecting the 2% price inflation that the BLS talks about, suddenly that will become just not believed at all. Now, it is at that stage that interest rates naturally will rise, and they will rise simply because the time preference between the ownership of goods now and the ownership of goods in the future is increasing because of the loss of purchasing power of the dollar. Mm-hmm. There mm-hmm. is only one thing that can happen, and that is that interest rates rise. They will continue to be suppressed, but they'll be suppressed at 5%. They'll be suppressed mm-hmm. at 10%. Mm-hmm. And as this spiral continues, possibly they will be suppressed at even higher nominal rates.
Right.
Now, the problem then is, look at what happens to government finances.
Finances
get completely mm-hmm. screwed because already, the interest bill last year was a bit over $400 billion. Now let us assume, well, first of all, we've now got in this current year, we've got a deficit which is running at $3.3 trillion. Next year, I guess it will probably be considerably more. We don't know, we'll see, but it could be easily $5 or $6 trillion. Now, the point is that at $3.3 trillion, the financing of the government deficit is now 50% taxes and 50% inflation.
That's crazy, yeah.
So, but from March, this switched over. It switched over, and the bulk of the financing is now through monetary inflation.
Right.
There is no way the dollar can hold up against other currencies while that happens.
Yeah.
To an extent, other currencies have the same problem. But
so as the foreigners walk away from the dollar, And I want to ask you about that with the time we have left, that the Chinese, your article on the Chinese, China is killing the dollar. The foreigners walk away. Somebody's got to buy the treasuries. And a growing number of demand for treasury demand, not demand for treasuries, but borrowing demands from the United States government to finance itself. It's going to grow just out of this world. I mean, it's just, there's no question about it. If you look at the economic situation in the U.S. and globally. So then as that happens, people start to say, wait a minute, the U.S. is printing money. They're hyperinflating, essentially. And as you say, time preference. So they have to have higher rates. So this could just really sort of snowball on itself, couldn't it? Really become a snowball.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Fed has the problem that not only will it be funding the U.S. government deficit and raising more than the government raises in taxes, but it will also have to absorb the selling, or someone will have to absorb the selling of U.S. Treasury debt by foreigners, and also the agency debt as well.
Right.
You know, and the importance of that article, the second article, was that China has obviously taken a decision that the one thing that she has got too much of, not copper, not gold, not anything like that, no commodity, but dollars. She's got something like, I mean, we don't know the exact figure, but it will be probably somewhere between 2.75 trillion and 3 trillion of dollars. And that, that is too much. And she's now, I think, from that March. Do you remember? We've talked about this before.
Yeah, March 23. Yeah, it was March a big, 23rd. Big date. Yeah.
You know, Powell says, whatever it takes. That's in effect what he said. And it was quite clear from that point that from the Chinese angle of holding up to, you know, almost $3 trillion, this is very bad news. They've got to get rid of them. And I think that was the decision that was, I was tipped off by Simon Hunt of Simon Hunt Strategic Services, who follows China immensely closely. He's got such good contacts there. But this is a decision that was taken at about that time. So, you know, I don't believe in coincidence until everything is ruled out. And to my mind, it is not a coincidence. It is, you know, they are related.
Well, you showed in your article, I think you showed the rising prices, at least from the 23rd on, we saw a distinct change in the markets, and the psychology of the markets started to change very dramatically, I would argue, from March 23rd, when Powell gave his whatever it takes speech. And China, according to your article, has been buying a lot of copper. I've read elsewhere as well that they're buying lots of commodities.
Yes.
And so they're really good. So how are they getting rid of the dollar? They're buying commodities. Is that how they're doing it? And then the other thing I want to ask you about with the 3 minutes we have left here is this issue of dumping treasuries. And there is an article that was written in a press that is the Global Times. It's China. It's a state-owned newspaper. Talk just briefly about that and why we might see a really a rapid sale of the dollars by China.
Yes, well, the first thing is that she is selling the dollars for commodities. It's as simple as that. So whoever sells the commodities ends up with the dollars. It's not China's problem. As far as the Global Times article is concerned, that was, I think, very surprising, because we know that the Chinese have been sort of playing this financial game, if you like, call it a financial war with America, which has been an underlying thing. I rather lost the thread of where I was going with this. The Global Times. I mean, that article would not have come out without it being sanctioned by central government. It's as simple as that. So the central government is warning, you know, look, unless policies change, whatever those policies might be, they put it into sort of military aggression. But I think it's wider than that. Unless it changes, we're out of the dollar and we're out of your bonds.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we're out of time. But I just say that if the Chinese are getting rid of dollars and foreigners are getting dollars and they do that first, it might be a wise thing for Americans to think about doing the same thing, at least to the extent they're able. So I want to thank you so much, Alistair, for sharing your insights, as always. Always a pleasure having you And it's always so valuable having you. So it's goldmoney.com, folks. Go there every Thursday. I think it's Thursday, right, Alistair? I'll get it right one of these
Correct.
Weeks.
Yes, it is.
Thursday, and you're going to write about what this time?
Well, this time I'm looking at history and the German inflation in 1923, okay. And also John Law and the lessons from that.
Excellent. Very good. All right. Well, that's it for this week, folks. Next week, I'm going to have Lynn Alden with me again. Peter Ball of NV Gold is with me, and Michael Oliver as well. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.